And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm pleased to welcome Eden Lapucky to the program today. Eden is a contributing editor for TheMillions.com and is the founder of Writing Workshops Los Angeles. She's the author of the novella, If You're Not Yet Like Me, and the New York Times bestselling novel, California. Today we'll be talking about her second novel, Woman No. 17, which is published by Crown. Eden, Woman 17 opens with a woman in Southern California hiring a nanny, and she's not all about the due diligence, is she?
She isn't. So Woman No. 17, it has two female characters, Lady, who is a 41-year-old mother of two, and she's recently kicked out her husband, Carl, and so she lives with her two sons, an 18-year-old son named Seth, who cannot speak, and her two-year-old Devin, who she needs a babysitter for, in this fabulous Hollywood Hills mansion. And she's on deadline to write a memoir about raising Seth. And she puts an ad on Craigslist to find a babysitter, a live-in nanny. She has a what she calls the cottage out back next to the swimming pool. And the first person she meets, it's the very opening of the book, is the second major character in the novel, and that is Esther Shapiro, who's going by S. Fowler. S is supposed to be short for Esther, the letter S. And right away they have a kind of repartee, and there's a sort of instant connection between them. And for whatever reason, Lady hires her on the spot, and she knows that her husband, Carl, would be upset to know that she didn't do a background check or, you know, call her references. But she feels just immediately comfortable and confident that S is the right person to hire. She points out that she's a graduate of Berkeley. She has an art history minor, and she sees that Devin and S connect, and she just hires her sort of without thinking. It's one of the first of many kind of impetuous actions that Lady takes in the novel.
Her thinking goes through a number of different points. I mean, she jumps from point to point, and she imagines drowning S.
Yes.
And she talks about S's clothes and how frumpy she looks, and
yes,
women
yes.
in Southern California are usually better dressed than her.
Yes, and yes. As soon as she opens the door, she's sort of surprised that it's not like a beautiful 22-year-old fashionable L.A. girl, but rather this woman wearing an unflattering dress. Her hair is flat, as she puts it. And she imagines pushing S into the pool when she's talking about Seth to her. So she reveals, oh, I actually have another son. He's not the one I'm hiring you to babysit, obviously. He's 18. He's been mute his whole life. And the kind of questions that S asks her, S has a psychology major in college, and so she asks her about, you know, oh, did you send him to speech therapy? And Lady is immediately defensive and just imagines her pushing her in to kind of get her to stop talking and to kind of retake the power of the situation. So clearly right away we see that Lady, she's very protective of Seth and has crafted this narrative about him and the relationship. And she always says, she refers it to her shtick that she says to people when she reveals that Seth doesn't speak. She says, like, I can't remember the exact words, but she says he's not autistic and he's not a genius either. And it's sort of her line that she gives at parties, you know,
just established pattern.
Yes, exactly. So, but in fact, the history of raising Seth and the fact of Seth's disability is not easy for her. So she has created this one sentence thing she can say to people, but really there's a whole lot of history underneath it and pain and frustration and all these other things.
Now, both S and Lady are our narrators, and they seem very open in what they share with us. But are they being honest with us?
I think that's the question at the center of the book. So they're both first-person narrators. Lady narrates for a few chapters, then we finally get to see S. You know, we see what Lady thinks of S, and then we see what S thinks of Lady. And, you know, the first scene of S, we get from Lady's perspective, and then we get S, who reveals to the reader that actually, oh, she'd had a couple beers before she came to this interview, and, oh, in fact, I'm doing an art project where I'm dressing like my mother, and I'm trying to be a 22-year-old version of my mother, who is an alcoholic and unstable, but also kind of fun and affectionate, and she was a nanny at my age. So she sort of tells us that she's being this other person, but I don't think S, or Lady for that matter, really know who they are. So for S to become someone else suggests she already knows herself, but she's sort of such a malleable person at this young age, and she's an artist. You know, neither of them I think, really know themselves very well. But they try their best to present otherwise, especially Lady. Her first person, I think, is much more like imperious and declarative. Like, I am the sort of person who is like this, and I do this, and this is how the world is. But I think the reader, I want the reader to be able to kind of see around her to what might be more true. And in fact, she's pretty vulnerable and she's trying to pretend otherwise. And S, as I said, is saying she's pretending to be someone else, and those boundaries are kind of blurring because she doesn't know her own identity.
They have so much of their action is based on reaction to other people, with Lady reacting to her mother's, Simone's, expectations, mm-hmm. and then S essentially trying to prove her college boyfriend wrong.
Yeah, yes. Yes. So Lady was raised by a very critical and manipulative woman named Simone, who's very beautiful and always commenting on how her daughter looks and how much she weighs and things like that. And that's a big source of pain for Lady. And she hasn't spoken to her mother since Seth was a baby. And that continues to be a kind of wound that she can't staunch. And she, like many people that I know who have some history of family dysfunction, unless they really work pretty hard and have the support of professionals and family, or maybe chosen family, they're sort of doomed to repeat that dysfunction. So I think Lady's in that situation where she has this resentment towards her mother, and she can't forgive her mother for certain things, that certain betrayals that her mother did when Seth was a baby. And so she's sort of replaying out some of those relationships in life now. So her mother, for instance, Simone, didn't let Lady see her father very much, Lady's father. Lady's really mad about that. And now we see Lady hasn't told Seth who his real father is, and also has kicked Carl out, which takes away Seth's stepfather and Devin's father. So she's sort of kind of doomed to repeat those errors. You know, S is 22. She's a heartbroken college graduate. Her boyfriend, Everett — I had a lot of fun writing Everett. He's an artist. He's a jerk. And he is going to Yale art school for graduate school. And I know a lot of visual artists, and I know people have gone to Yale, but that's like the it school to get into if you're an artist, so I'm told. So I had him get into Yale, and he does all these sort of, I don't know what you would call them. First of all, he's just obsessed with his art. That's all he is. She says sort of like there's no soul to him. It's just the things he makes and talks about. It's just all consuming. I don't know. She sort of wants to get his attention in some roundabout way, and is kind of trying to, I think, in the way that she becomes her mother, she's sort of trying to be like him. She's doing this kind of intense art project, trying to think, okay, if I'm an artist in the way that Everett is an artist, will I have more power? Will I move more freely through the world? If maybe if this art project is strong enough, he will see it somewhere and reach out to me. Because one of the things, when he broke up with her, he told her, like, you're just a painter. Like, art isn't what you're all about. And I think, you know, he was disappointed in her, felt that she wasn't quite up to snuff to be his artistic girlfriend.
It's always nice to find fault in the other person,
yeah,
on
it?
The way out. So Lady is unwittingly becoming her mother. And S has, yes, a purpose in becoming her mother, I guess, because she feels alienated from her in some way.
Yes.
So she has to understand what went on with her mother and her parents' divorce. And
yes. So S's parents divorced when she was really young. Her mother left her father for just some cute guy she saw.
A skateboarder.
Yeah, a skateboarder. Can't remember what I made him on. I think first he had one little fun job, and I was like, he's got to be a skateboarder. So for one affair, the marriage broke up, and she's been shuttling back and forth between them. And I think S really does want to connect with her mother. She's not like Lady in that she hasn't pushed her away. She recognizes that her mother has boundary issues, so she can't tell her everything. But she does want her mother's attention and love. And they do have a strangely close relationship in some ways. Like, there's a scene where S goes to see her mom in her mom's apartment, and they are sort of cuddling while her mother sews her dress. And there is a sense of affection and intimacy there. But at the same time, S has lived her whole life kind of taking care of her mother, making sure, for instance, her mother doesn't get evicted, that she pays her rent, you know, that she does all the things that she needs to do in order to be a working member of society. So her mom is a functioning alcoholic, but some of that function S has taken responsibility for. And so I think by becoming her, she's trying to understand who this woman is. She feels very different from her mother, and I think she is quite different from her mother. I don't think that S is an alcoholic as much as she wants to try to become one. And the whole project is sort of built on deceit, becoming someone you're not. And Her mother, though she may drink to obliterate some part of herself, always moves through the world as herself. She's very much her own being. She has a way of speaking that suggests that she doesn't really care what people think of her, for better or for worse. And S is kind of the opposite of that. She cares very much what people think of her. So I think she wants some of the positive qualities of her mother.
How similar is that to actually writing and creating fictional characters for literature?
It's pretty similar. I mean, my life is pretty boring. Like, I have two kids, I'm married. I've been married for a long time, and I just make breakfast and I go do my writing. Then I, you know, pay a bill, I walk my dog, I pick up my kids, hang out with my husband, read a book, then I'm done with the day. When I'm writing, I get to be in these kind of very messy characters' lives and become them. And I didn't do any of the things that they do in the book. And I would say that my mothering, thank goodness, is pretty different from there. But I did, for a moment, get to be them, both of them. Everyone in the book I got to be to some degree. I got to imagine what everyone was wearing, how everyone was feeling. And I feel like, especially if I'm writing in public, I'll catch myself, like, when I'm writing dialogue especially, I can catch myself, like, wiggling around, sort of acting out both sides. you can't see that I'm making a silly face right now. So I do think there is a sense of performance in fiction writing that is becoming literal in the novel itself.
Talk about the challenges of writing dialogue for a 2.5-year-old.
Actually, the challenges for writing the dialogue for the 2.5-year-old weren't that difficult because he is based entirely on my child. His middle name is Bean, and that's what we call him. Bean is now almost 6, but when I started the book, he was the age that Devin is. And so I just kind of started writing things down, and I have all these videos of him. So as he aged, obviously, his language got more developed, but I would go back and watch the videos to make sure I had the syntax correct. And some of the sentences of the book, like when Devin says, "I'll put you on the rug and boom," that was something my son said, and I was like, oh, I have to put that in the novel because it's the kind of thing that 2.5-year-olds say that doesn't make sense, but it's really cute and weird. But I was actually very proud because my editor first and then the copy editor said to me, I think that this child is too advanced. And I said, well, that's based on my child, so I'll take that as a compliment, and it's going to stay as is.
Lady is very bright, and Carl, her husband, is very bright.
Yes.
So it makes sense they would have a bright child.
Of course, right? And I also wanted it, you know, some people say, well, did you want to purposefully show that he is extremely verbal, whereas Seth, Lady's first son, doesn't speak at all? And I can't say I did that intentionally to begin with, although I did want Lady to feel very keenly what it felt like to raise a child who spoke after raising a child who didn't. So how different that would feel to, you know, have a 2-year-old who really had a hard time expressing himself and then move to another child and the memory and the present just not matching up in all these various ways. One, you now are married, you now live in a very nice house. Your child is speaking to you, demanding things, whereas before you were a single mother, very isolated with a child who was frustrated and you were frustrated to try to communicate. So I wanted those two sides of two different kinds of parenting to be felt by the reader too.
With Seth not being able to speak, he's not diagnosed at the beginning of the book. We don't know what exactly might be his problem. Did you have to start writing him with a specific diagnosis in mind so that his behavior would be consistent in some way?
Seth was probably the hardest part of the novel to write. The idea for the novel came because my son, when he was 15 months old, didn't speak. And I started to think, like, well, what if he never speaks? Like, what will that be like for him? More importantly, how will that sort of change how I parent him or how we interact? And it just got me really thinking, and I wanted to write about a mother who wouldn't be heroic in her advocating for her child and wouldn't really know what to do. So he was silent from the beginning. I know I didn't want him to be a silent child. I wanted that to be in the past. So I started writing, and right away I knew that if he had been diagnosed with autism or some other challenge, that would be really difficult for him to be an agent in the drama of the narrative. I wanted him to be able to understand and negotiate and even manipulate small social clues in the novel so that he could be part of the plot in a really, you know, central way. And I thought if he had a hard time communicating in all ways, that would be really difficult for the novel and the drama would be kind of inert. And to be honest, I didn't feel up to the task. I want to leave that work for an autistic writer or a parent of an autistic child, because I feel like that will be a story that needs to be told and is getting told now. So I just had him be silent, and I met with a friend who's a speech therapist, and I said, okay, this is what I have so far. I mean, I had like 40 pages at that point. And she kind of talked me through the possibilities of what could be, quote unquote, wrong with him. And mutism or selective mutism is kind of what we agreed would work. And that's not really a diagnosis that fully captures what's going on with Seth, because usually people who have selective mutism talk to somebody. Like, they might not talk to anybody at a restaurant or at school, but they talk to their brother because they're really comfortable with their brother. And oftentimes people who are selective mutes are just experiencing, not just, but they do experience really intense social anxiety, like debilitating social anxiety, and or they are autistic. They're on the spectrum of some kind. So I thought it would be really interesting if he had this diagnosis, but it didn't really get at what was going on with him. So he has this diagnosis only because there is no diagnosis for him. And, you know, there's a point where Lady is describing all the tests that she had him take, like checking his diaphragm and his tongue and all these things, having a blood test to make sure there's not some other genetic happening, but nothing really fully captures what is wrong with him. And that is a source of unease for Lady, because then she has to ask herself, well, why doesn't he talk? There's nothing actually physically wrong with him. And he has a very popular Twitter account, and he can write you notes, and he can make faces and do sign language and do all these things. So that kind of sets her off on this journey of trying to figure out, like, okay, well, what is it? What did I do to make him like this? And I have a friend who's a therapist, and we talked a lot about trauma and the way that trauma can often cause children to stop talking or to never speak. And of course, Seth has not witnessed trauma or experienced trauma in the ways that my friend, the therapist, was talking about. You know,
but hearing the Stooges really loud when you're a child over and over.
Yeah, it's true. Yes, his father did play "I Want to Be Your Dog" at top volume, but that might have caused him to go deaf. So, you know, but I think Lady is kind of so self-absorbed, for lack of a better word, and she herself is not over the fact that Seth's father has left her or that her mother has betrayed her, that she kind of takes on that trauma, and she takes that trauma and kind of gives it to Seth as one of the possible reasons why he might be silent now.
Some kind of weird variation of Munchausen by proxy or
yes,
something like that.
Exactly. Yeah, totally. But Seth was really hard to write because I wanted to make sure that people didn't think I was just like putting in like a mysterious mute just for my own needs. I wanted to make sure that he was a real character who had real needs and desires, and that he was his disability. That was a real influence on his life and who he became, but also he's not only his disability. And I have talked to friends who have children with disabilities, or they know, you know, my friend has a brother whose son is nonverbal at like 4. And she said she felt like it was a rich and real description of that. So that felt really good. And that was the one I had. I lost the most sleep over that out of anything in the whole book.
At one point he goes, "I'm not a metaphor."
Exactly. I just put it right in the book.
But aren't all literary characters just metaphors?
I guess. They're stand-ins for us, right? There is a long history of, you know, people with disability being used as metaphors in fiction, you know, like Ahab with his wooden leg. So I was like, I'm just going to put this right into the book. And I do think that Lady and S use Seth in order to understand themselves. So they're not at times really seeing him fully.
Because just with his physical language, it's so much of it is projection from the other person in the conversation.
Exactly. And talk about a hard time writing dialogue. 2.5-year-olds are a breeze compared to somebody who doesn't speak. I was like, I can't have Seth raise his eyebrows anymore. He has to do something else. That was really tough.
Well, those special signs he had,
yes,
with his family, and the fact that they didn't have a very concrete meaning, that they had pointed to some other emotion. It's almost like how you'd take a word like from German, Gemütlichkeit, for the coziness and everything. And that it really, coziness really doesn't encapsulate what it means. It's one of those like foreign words,
yes,
that we can't really translate into English.
Exactly. Yes. So Seth and Lady, when he was young, came up with these secret signs or special signs. Now, I wrote it and I don't even remember. That's how it goes. Between them, so they're not ASL signs. One of them is like burrito flower, got it, ninja mama. They're sort of silly. They're the kind of things that I could imagine that my son and I would have at a very young age, like our, you know, a little secret language. But you're right. One of the reasons that Lady treasures them is that it only exists between the two of them. How each sign comes into being has its own story. They create the signs after something has happened, and they need that sign to express something. So only the two of them understand that fully. And when she finds out that Seth has been teaching the signs to other people, it feels really painful to her. And from the outside, I think the reader and some of the other characters are like, what's the big deal? Like, get over it. It's good that he's reaching out to other people. But I also think the reader can see why that would hurt her.
Well, of course, she has made him her life.
Yes.
And then it's not reciprocated in that she is his totality.
Yes. And I feel like parents of teenagers, there is they often experience, so this, my children are young enough, but I know someday, you know, my son and daughter won't like hug me in the same way. And they'll just be like, see you later, mom, and take off with their friends. And I'll feel that kind of pain. But hers is magnified because Seth's father left and it was just the two of them. And she kept them kind of cloistered. And Seth was everything and is everything. Even now that when she's remarried and has a second child, she's still kind of grieving the loss of Seth, or she's not accepting that he's growing up.
Now, is there any significance that your name is Eden and his name is Seth?
I don't understand.
Seth was the third child of Adam and Eve.
Oh, I didn't know that, actually. There is no significance.
He's the progenitor of Noah.
Oh, I didn't know that. You're the first person to tell me that. I love interviews because I always learn something new about my book. I hope somebody writes a thesis about this someday. No, Seth just was there on the page. Sometimes I pick names really intentionally, and other times I just let a name come into sort of arrives. And I liked Seth because it was the inverse of S, and there's so much mirroring in the book. So we have S and Seth. It's almost like saying it backwards or something. And I liked that echo there.
Ooh, and I want to talk to you about all this mirroring going on between S and Lady. First, we have the names. We have both of them go by names other than their given names.
Yes. Actually, the first thing I ever wrote for the book, I wrote it and then I didn't touch it for a couple months and I came back to it. The beginning of chapter 2 where Lady says, I wasn't always named Lady. And she describes how her name was Pearl and how her mother renamed her Lady when she was putting on her mother's high heels. And her mother said, oh, like, look at that lady or something. And then she had a new name. So she was given her new name. And S, who's Esther, gives herself the new name. So she's the agent of the transformation, whereas Lady is, it's sort of hoisted upon her, which is kind of, you talk about metaphors for both how they both move through the world. You know, what's funny, I think, with writing is, at least for me, I try to kind of remove my conscious mind from any of the deeper subjects of the narrative until I'm farther into it. Because I worry if I'm thinking too much about it, my hand will be too heavy. And so if things start popping up that connect, I'll sort of notice them, but I won't question why they're that way. So I actually didn't recognize that S, this like echo or mirroring of that particular issue was even there for a little while until I was like, oh, that's so obvious. But it had already happened. It was already in the text. So I felt like it was right. And then later, the book almost took on a life of its own where it had a kind of, it was almost like a hysterical mirroring where like just things that I would put in one thing popped up in a slightly different version in another element. I'm trying to think of an example, like the fact that Lady was remembering when she first gets pregnant with Seth, when she's still with Seth's father, Marco. She works for a woman who she calls the actress, who is like an elderly woman who is famous for being in a cult horror movie. And she does all kinds of things for her around the house. And she lives in this huge mansion in Beverly Hills. And then there was a point where I realized, oh, that's kind of what S's job is. I mean, Lady is an elderly and she's not an actress, but there is a mother-daughter surrogacy that happens between the actress and Lady at this point in her life because Lady's not talking to her mother, just in the same way that Lady and S have this mother-daughter surrogacy happening because of all kinds of mommy issues that they have. So things like that just kept popping up and gaining energy as I wrote more. Flannery O'Connor, I love her book, Mystery and Manners, which is a book, I think they're lectures, but they're now written out. And she talks about how meaning in a story is accumulated. It's accumulated as you move through the story as a reader. Like you can't step away from a story and just say what it's about. You have to actually be inside the story to gather it. And that's how I feel about how the writing works too. So the kind of mirroring that happened, I mean, the whole story is about identity and representation and the way these women connect or disconnect. And so it makes sense that all those repetitions and echoes and distortions would happen. And I sort of just let it go.
And they both have older men in their lives who are very kind, but really don't give them any pushback or opposition.
That's true.
And in S's case, it's her father, Stephen Shapiro. And in Lady's life, it's Carl, her husband, who's older.
One. Yes,
but
totally.
They both kind of have the same approach that they are supportive and very kind, but they don't push back when they need to.
They could push, both of them could push back a little bit more, I think, but they don't. You're right. There are these support systems. And it's one of the reasons I think that Lady pushes Carl away is that he lets her push her away. And you're totally right. I never thought of that.
Her pushing starts at the very beginning of the relationship when she, not forces, but says she wants to go to P.F. Chang's on their first date.
Yes.
And it's just to see if he would do it.
Yes. And she realizes that she wields this kind of minor but important power over him, that he'll sort of do what she wants. And I wanted to write Carl like a, I wanted him to be super likable. I was like, I know some readers might bristle at these other characters, these very damaged women who are behaving badly, but I wanted Carl to be like lovable. And it's been interesting. A lot of people are like, Carl's the only one in the book I can stand. I mean, I love to hate the other ones and I love to love Carl. And then there have been a few readers who actually really are angry at Carl for doing exactly that, of just letting Lady have her way. It's just been really fascinating to see people's reactions. But I love Carl. He's so fun to write.
Carl is also a big fan of literature. And it's ironic that it's Lady who gets the book deal.
Yes. But he's so supportive. Carl's kind of a snobby guy. You know, he wants to hear who won the Booker. And I can't really imagine him reading that many memoirs, like tell-all memoirs about parenting. He's supportive of Lady. But if she were to write a literary novel, I wonder if he'd be a little jealous.
And she herself is disdainful of the mommy blog.
Oh, yes. I mean, the only reason why she's writing this memoir is she wrote this piece in Real Simple magazine that went viral about raising Seth. And she recognizes that the memoir as it's built, which is like a narrative of triumph and overcoming adversity and the beauty of motherhood, is all a lie for her, you know. But she realizes that, and she's like supposed to be writing it anyway. She signed the contracts.
Do you think you could have written this book before Twitter and everything that goes down on Twitter in the book?
I don't think so. Well, California, my first novel, which is, you know, for lack of a better word, post-apocalyptic, it has no technology. It's the end of the world. There's no cell phones. And that was refreshing. It's really fun to write a book. I can see why there's a lot of books right now that take place in the 90s, because nobody wants to deal with the technology question. Because to write a story where questions can be answered in a minute by looking up where the address is on Google Maps or getting a, you know, texting or whatever. But I did want to write after California. I really was itching to write something that was intensely contemporary. My friend the other day was like, I can't believe you worked Trader Joe's into your novel. And I was like, I needed to put everything in it that's contemporary. And technology and social media are so part of our everyday lives. And so I don't think I could have written it without Twitter, for instance, because it's relevant on a thematic level, thinking about representation and the ways that we express ourselves. I mean, Seth can't speak, but he communicates beautifully and powerfully, and he's big on Twitter. He's really funny on Twitter, and he has a lot of followers. So that's one thing. And then I wanted the technology, the social media, internet stuff, especially to have a part in the plot. So I wanted it to make sense thematically, but I also wanted story to be revealed that way. So that was a really fun challenge for me. It's like, well, how can I use Twitter so that there is some reveal in that way? And I remember there was a time when, like, going around on the internets, there was like, it was like Pride and Prejudice told through like Facebook status updates. It was something, it was a classic novel that was told through like status updates and replies, and it was really clever. And, you know, it's like, OMG, I just met Mr. Darcy or whatever. And so I think that was strangely part of my inspiration of like, how can you use the ways that we show our experiences, you know, from the mundane to the intense, how can I use that and put this in this novel?
While having the modern technology does take away some of the mystery aspect of what a story could have, that's set in the past where immediate knowledge isn't available at all times, I also think maybe writers are not really sure how technology actually is fitting into our lives and how it's affecting us, so they're kind of afraid to approach it.
It's interesting because so many writers I know are on Twitter like way too much, and yet they're not wrestling with that stuff in their work. I think because also, I think people, because it's so part of our everyday lives and we don't know really how it's changing us or what we really, I think most people have a very conflicted relationship with the internet and our smartphones. You know, we like to have all the information in our pocket right away and to be able to text our loved ones if we need to, and the community that it offers. It's much easier to work all day alone if you can, it's like the water cooler that's always there. You know, if someone's always standing around that water cooler. But I also think people feel chained to it, that they feel like they have to check it all the time. If this fear of disappearing if you're not on it. It's just, I think people feel pulled in both directions. And I also think some authors, I mean, I felt like this, but I was like, oh my God, I have Twitter in my book. Will anybody take me seriously? I think that's a real fear to think about, like, well, Facebook is definitely part of our lives, many people's lives. And yet, does it not feel like quote-unquote literature if Facebook is part of the human I mean, can you make a novel, write a novel about the human condition without Facebook now?
But the thing that ends up being the most important bit of technology in the book is over 150 years old, and that is photography.
That's true.
The photograph of
you
woman number
17. You are a sharp reader. That's very true. I mean, in the end, I think, you know, as much as we use these new technologies, I started this Instagram project that is inspired by the book. In the book, S puts a call out on the internet for pictures of people's mothers before they became mothers. And she starts to do a whole project where she stages the photo. She makes herself the mother and re-photographs herself. And then she paints the photo that she stages, et cetera. So I thought it would be really interesting to collect photos of people's mothers before they were mothers. And I was really amazed by the photos I got and how mysterious a lot of the photos were and how magical they were. And these are old photos, you know, it's an older technology, you know, these are film photos. Some of them are from like the 20s and some are from the 80s, but it struck me how much we value these images from the past and how so much is felt in them. So these are not mothers that I know. These are strangers' mothers. And yet even I can be kind of mesmerized by the images there and the stories they tell. And I think especially knowing that they're film photographs makes us feel like they're more valuable. Like this person took this. They didn't know what it looked like. They had to get it printed out. They saved this one photograph. And now it's much more disposable. You can take hundreds of photographs and then delete them on your phone. So in the same way in the book, the novel is named after a photograph. So Woman Number 17 is a photograph that Carl's sister, the famous photographer Kit Daniels, took. She photographed a series of women and none of them have names. They're all numbered. So Lady was Woman Number 17. And it's a photo that's now hanging in Carl and Lady's house, although it's hanging in their closet for reasons that you have to read to find out. And S, who has, you know, is an art history minor, loves photography. She's an artist. She loves Kit Daniels' work. And she becomes fixated on this photo and what it might say about Lady and about women in general and about what Kit's intentions were photographing Lady and all of the women. And I can really identify with that because when I see old photos, not just fine art photography, I have all of those same questions of like, how staged is this? What is left outside of the frame that I find really intriguing?
And when you were talking about Kit Daniels, I really didn't think about you as the author in the process of reading the book, except for when Kit Daniels, the photographer, really loves to see the photos and the detritus of people's lives,
yes.
the junk, the clutter that's in their candid shots around their homes. And I was wondering if that was a fascination.
It's so me. So there's a line about how Kit has this abandoned art project where she's obsessed with photos on real estate blogs or, you know, what, like Redfin or Trulia, one of those. You know, most of those houses now are staged where there's not even a power cord in sight and they're all beautiful. But there are still photos of people's houses they've taken that are for sale where the people still live there and they're just like totally trashed. I love these photos. I can look at them. I'll click through them and look at all the strange things that people have in their homes. It's like a glimpse into this very private space. You know, there's the like, there'll be like deodorant in the kitchen. There's so many weird things in these pictures that always make me want to think about like, well, who lives in this house? What's their situation? Why are these weird things misplaced? Why is that chair in the bathtub? You know, those kind of questions. And so that is totally me and that's Kit now. And yeah, so I love that sort of voyeurism. And I think fiction is kind of the ultimate voyeurism.
When we talk about the echoes that are between Lady and S, I often find that I have echoes between books and authors that come in. They seem, every once in a while, they're paired
cousins.
Up.
Yeah.
And I just spoke with Ann Patchett about her recent book, Commonwealth, which came out in paperback recently. And both of your books are very different books, but they both share the fact of someone not in the direct relationship has made art from the family and the effect that that art has on the family.
I want to read it, and it's on my list because everyone loves it. And everyone is like, oh, it's a great LA. There's LA section, so I got to read it, of course. But I haven't read it yet, but somebody should have told me that sooner.
Inside the book, there is a book called Commonwealth, which is about the family that is the main part of the story, but someone in the family did not write the book themselves.
Ooh, that's
but
intriguing.
Took advantage of their story to write it.
I would think that I would feel so fragile if I read a book that was about me that I didn't write or that if a photograph was taken of me that didn't, like, in the way that Lady does, feel like it didn't capture the way that I want to be seen by the world. You can see Ann Patchett's book is so successful because families have so many, not necessarily secrets, but kind of an unstated understanding of how it works. And then to have that laid bare, that really would rock a family. I could see that.
Well, hers is more kind of like the Brady Bunch goes bad.
Okay.
In a way. And yours is more like single white female. It's kind of goofy.
Yeah. I like both of those descriptions.
Well, have you started working on another project yet?
I have. So the young adult novelist Cecil Castellucci, who's my friend, told me when I sold California, my first book, she told me some advice that Amy Bender had told her, which was finish your new book before your first book comes out. So as soon as I sold California, I started working on Woman Number 17. I didn't finish it, but I had like 120 pages so that when I was done promoting California, I could go back to my office and I didn't have a blank page like screaming at me, which seems like just so terrifying. I had this new book to write, which is really different from California, but it was already itself. Lady and S and Devin and Seth, they were all Kit Daniels. They were all there waiting for me in all their glory. So I tried to take that advice again. I didn't get quite as far as last time. I have about 70 pages of something new, and it's pretty different from Woman Number 17 in California, but it still takes place in L.A., and I'm sure the characters I know they're pretty, like, messed up.
So did the process of going on tour and doing a lot of press interviews and meeting readers change you or your writing in any way to really understand that the book has a life outside of yourself?
I don't think it changed my writing process, both a good and bad way. Writing is the same. It's always been the way it is. It's just hard and really satisfying. So the writing process hasn't changed. And I think in part because I already had started writing Woman Number 17. I think if I had gone and done all the promotion for California and then had nothing, I could have been more influenced by what I was told or what I thought people might want next. And instead, I had this book and it, for better or for worse, that was the book everyone was going to get. I think promoting California, though, taught me just that a book does have a life of its own, that it's not yours after it becomes a book. When it's a document on your computer, it's your own little baby. And then you send it out to kindergarten and it's off into the world. And people respond to it as they want to. And you hope that people love it and connect with it. But you also know it's not for everyone. And that's okay, too. I mean, one of the most exciting things for both novels is what we're doing here, where people tell me what my own book is about. And I learn something about the characters that I didn't know before. And you think that the author would be the foremost expert on all things related to the book. But as we know from Michel Foucault, the author's dead and I don't matter, and that the reader actually can provide the meaning that I'm searching for. So that's just the most fun part for me, is to learn something.
Well, Eden, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me.
Eden LaPucky is the author of Woman Number 17, which is published by Crown. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.